Hello. I work for the government. I have no financial disclosures to make. Today, well, I'm from the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health, Alcohol and Drug Program Administration. Just a little background. Our little unit has about 200 staff members, of which 25 are auditors that audit over 300 agencies who have contracts with our program. And then the other half are finance and budget people who monitor the incoming and outgoing income and money and all sorts of that stuff that most of the public health people like me kind of are see as the black hole. But there is this movement towards changing contracts to performance-based contracts and having a relatively large, although local, jurisdiction. We were kind of faced with trying to figure out how are we going to do this without having everybody go out of business or freaking everybody out about saying, we're going to give you an A, B, C grade like the restaurants do in Los Angeles with their sanitation. So we looked at a new concept that was coming out in our field called process improvement to see if that was something we would want to implement as part of the performance-based contracting component. So today what I'd like to share with you, and just as a background, there's 50 slides here. I don't intend to read to you all 50 slides, but it will be on the web. So for those of you who are interested, you could go back and kind of take a look at what you'd like to do. I wanted to cover what our game plan is, where we were, where we are now, where we're going, and how we're going to try to get there. But before we get started, I thought it would be good to talk to you about what is called the rapid cycle testing, which is the main component of process improvement, which is basically four components: PDSA, plan the change. What kind of change do you want to make? And then once you plan that out, you do it. Once you do it, you study the results, and you act on the new knowledge and figure out what you need to do once you have the results. So the challenge for us was trying to figure out how to get our people to collect data and actually look at data and work with data. So that was one of our challenges. So as part of our initial plan, and the whole slide structure is also on the PDSA cycle, because that's what we try to use during our planning processes, is to plan. We wanted to find out, well, what is NIATX? What is process improvement? Is it something LA County can really use? Is it something our contracted agencies can really use? And who are the experts that we need to tap into to make this happen? And so NIATX, for those of you who don't know, is a partnership between the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which seems to fund a lot of things in the AOD field, CSAT, and single state authorities. And a few years ago, they had opened up grant funding for states to partner with CSAT and Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and NIATX to really try pilot projects on whether or not process improvement would work in the treatment field. We thought this was great. So although we were a county, we thought, okay, we'll be obnoxious and try to submit anyways. We were declined because we were not a state, but they thought that it would be interesting to try it at a local level. So they actually put us aside and gave us some funding for us to work with at the local level. So that's kind of where our phase one started. And so what NIATX does is they share process improvement strategies that help us maximize the use of our very limited resources and learn innovative strategies through peer networking, have our 300 contracted agencies actually start talking to one another about what they think works in their agencies, what they think don't work, and kind of commiserate about their challenges and come up with ideas that they may have not done in the past. And basically model organizational improvements in addiction treatment. And this was the reason why I was actually hired within the Alcohol and Drug Program. My background is actually in food safety and have absolutely no real background in alcohol and drug treatment until I came to this program. But what I was doing in food safety was quality improvement and process improvement for food safety manufacturers and distributors. So, you know, I thought, well, that's kind of strange going from manufacturing canned products to doing alcohol and drug purity. But it turns out that the process is all the same no matter where you go, including planning a party, planning a wedding, or going out to dinner, or even going to the grocery store, because, you know, you have to first plan out what you want to buy at the grocery store, get there and keep focused on your list. You come back and you realize you forgot something, so you try not to, you know, make that same mistake again the next time. So that whole concept of PDSA, we are constantly doing. So it's a very, you know, easy concept, really, to grasp once you get it. And they just put language to it, so it sounds like this ooh thing. But it's a systematic way of approaching problem solving, and they really make it more client and customer based. They actually would ask the customers, how would you like us to improve so that we could give you better treatment? Which tends to get forgotten, especially when there's high levels of burnout, when there's so many people to see, when it's just, you know, there's so many things going on that you forget. And they were evaluating internal processes and maximize the use, again, of the limited resources. So the four aims, the four types of changes that NIATECHS recommended were, one, to reduce wait time, two, reduce no-shows, three, to increase admissions, and four, to increase continuation rates. And what NIATECHS found is that if you do these four, it will actually improve the probabilities of one recovering or getting better. So they said these are the four areas of focus, and so we're actually looking at these four aims as areas for our criteria for what we would consider performance-based contracts, that if you, by improving these, would be actually making a performance improvement. So that's what we're looking at right now. But as a summary of what we used as our pilot project is to apply the rapid cycle testing, the PDSA, use the quick start roadmap, which was a written down flow chart of what you were going to do, measure the impact of the change, and depending on the results, either sustain the change and make it institutionalized within your or abandon the change, abort, and move on to something new. So the three questions that we started with is, what are we trying to accomplish? And the participants of the pilot project were allowed to pick whatever aim they wanted to work on. So we didn't force everybody to do one or the other. We wanted them to measure, we wanted them to figure out a way to measure their baseline. And this was a struggle. So we ended up working with UCLA to come up with a Excel spreadsheet that they could use to populate, and it would automatically give off charts and bar graphs and everything else, which they really liked. And the change was, what changes can we test? And so what we did was, we tried to look for someone like Dr. Spock in the field of process improvement. And in our case, we used a gentleman by the name of Dr. Steve Gallen, who's one of the leading experts in process improvement. And we also partnered, since we don't we're not, as government employees, we're not the most data familiar, and don't know much about regressions and analysis. So we've gotten our partners from UCLA helping us with the research aspects. And then, of course, my boss, who was the interim director at the time of the Alcohol and Drug Program Administration, and myself is number one. So we were the team. And so we did it. We tried out the pilot project and wanted to find out from our initial pilot project, you know, will the agencies be willing to implement this? You know, how receptive will they be? What kind of problems and challenges are we going to face during the implementation? And are we really ready to do this to all of our 300 contracted agencies at once? So, you know, we went through these two pilot phases, phase one and phase two. We just finished our phase two last week, and we had a celebration for it. But in our phase one, we had six outpatient and one residential program participate. And these were some of the objectives: find out whether agencies can really integrate it, would they be receptive, would they get it. And, you know, it was great. We started with a one-day workshop to really give them a lot more information about process improvement. We had the executive directors act like patients and walk through their entire facility, from calling in and they used anonymous names. Some of the executive directors actually try to act like they were high when they went in, and they really realized and were eye-opened by some of the things that they didn't realize until they actually took that process. They didn't realize that having an iron gate with wires on top would not be very welcoming. So people, you know, having lobbies that are really dreary looking was not good. So those types of things, those are the small things that, but really start to make a difference. And so they did that. They wrote it up. And then we started having monthly conference calls with the change leaders who were in charge of doing this at their individual sites. And the experts would then periodically go in. So the evaluation of phase one, we saw marked improvements in no-show rates. It was an 80% improvement. And these were from, and these were not major changes. These were literally adding a reminder card, giving them the dates of their four next appointments, calling them the night before, calling them the morning of. So it was these very minor changes that made these significant differences. So we thought this was great. Continuation rates also, it was harder to measure because we had a smaller sample, but we saw a 6% improvement in continuation. So with time running out, some of the problems and challenges were indirect costs to the staff and trying to get their groups together, having a change leader, a strong agency leadership and support, getting them to really learn about data collection process and reading and looking at data, and decreasing the client turnover. And this was a culture change, but the success was that it really increased profits for the agencies because they limited and minimized the number of vacant spots during their treatments and their beds. And it really improved staff morale. They really, a lot of these people say, we've been doing it the same way, why should we change now? You know, this is another gimmick by LA County. You know, boo-hoo-hoo. But by the end, all of these naysayers were really turned around and converted. They're like, what is the next change we're going to make to see these kinds of improvements? And it was really an eye-opening experience for the executive directors who were running these programs for quite a while. So what we did was in phase two, we tried to see if we could do this, but with I'm going to keep going. With more agencies, and we try to focus more on residential and as well as youth facilities to see if we'll see the same kind of data. And what we ended up seeing, I'm going to skip over to the last part, is our wait time for this new cohort went down 37% average improvement in wait time from first contact to admissions. So it started at 6 days and went down to 3.8. For the people working on wait time arrival to meeting with the assessor, it went down 11%. And no shows again, this was a 38% average improvement. And 30-day continuation was 6%. And the 30-day continuation is a little bit harder to measure because it takes so much longer to get the results. So they're going to be measuring for another 2 months to see if we could kind of improve. Session by session, attendance went up 21%. And client attending four sessions per month, which is what NIATX recommends, went up by 126%. And some of the incentives that they did were if all of the group members showed up for all four, they would have a pizza party at the end. A lot of the Dodgers and some of the Lakers donated tickets as incentives, and people really were excited about things like that. And then admission, actually, this was terrific. The admissions went up by 192% just by changing the way the receptionist answered the phone calls and called it in. This is drastic for small changes. So where do we go from here? The thing now is we've kind of decided that process improvement works. And people, once they get started, and when our completion conference ended last week, you know, I told some of the participation, congratulations, you completed this project. And what I thought was great is the gentleman said to me, what do you mean completed? We're just beginning. We're going to take this to all of our other sites. We're going to do this with other parts of our facility and our programs. And I think that's what good policy is to make that institutional cultural change within the organizations. So we're thinking that when we move forward with performance-based policy, contracts, that we would recommend this as a tool that they use, but come up with specific measures, whether it's reducing time no-shows or whatever it is that the agencies get to choose, and that's the direction we're going in. And thank you very much for your time.
And we have some time for questions.
Yep.
That's a very good point. And actually, one of the other analyses we did was led by Yvonne Terry McElrath, and they tend to be larger. She looked at what predicted whether or not you'd accept Medicaid, and the larger ones were more likely to. So yes, size mattered. I think it's a very good point. Maybe the reason that the programs that accept it offer more services is that they're very OCD, and you know, therefore they know how to do stuff. But you're correct, and our data suggests, you know, very consistently for the not-for-profits and the for-profits that decision relates to better services. So you're right. The more it's transparent and easy the state can make it, the more they may do for you know, quality and comprehensive improvement.
First of all, thank you, the entire panel. I learned a lot from your presentation. But another question for Dr. McBride, if I may. A lot of states are trying to figure out how to leverage Medicaid funds from the feds.
Yeah.
And one way to do that is to shift, you know, services that you're currently funding from state block grant funds over to Medicaid when that's appropriate. So my question for you is about the impact you showed in the Medicaid program was somewhat heartening.
Yeah. I think NCESS is about the best we have. It's you know, I've seen some smaller studies that indicate 85-90%. Coverage. I mean, we have NCESS first behind it. It's really pretty comprehensive and pretty representative, and especially it tends to represent the more stable programs, you know, that turn in the data. So it's a decent representation of the nation.
And then a follow up to that, of those 25,000, about what percentage do you know actually have some Medicaid penetration?
Well, about 20% accept Medicaid. I'm sorry, about 20% of all payment comes from Medicaid. In terms of the percent that accepted Medicaid, I mean, and it varies a lot by government. Not for, you know, government is very high, the for-profits much lower. So it really varied by ownership. But, you know, the government probably well over 80%. But some government did, which interested me. But those are more county taxes that paid for it. But it increases for the not-for-profits are the most likely. 70-80% of them accepted. The for-profits was more down to 20% that accepted. But again, you know, that's a fairly large number, and once they did, we saw those relationships. The point about ease and transparency is important. The easier it is to get in the system, the more impact it may have. In my colleague Jamie Schrieke's poster in a half hour really focuses on the specificity of state policies and what the programs offer. She basically found when a state writes specific policies, to be licensed in our state, Medicaid, you offer this, this, and this, the programs do it. So general Medicaid authorization in the states for drug treatment that was general didn't relate to the ancillary and the medical. But if the state put that in their enabling legislation that you will do this, it really made a huge difference. So I guess we would encourage that not only we work to get Medicaid accepted, but that states do specificity in the Medicaid authorization. National is really important. The more specific the license requirements are, really can make a huge difference. And I think we're in an era, we just ended an era when we believed that regulations didn't matter. We showed didn't really work well in the stock market. And maybe our society is really looking at regulations as how it can improve things. And certainly our data suggested that if you do regulate and specify that to offer services in our state, you will do this, this, and this, it made a real difference.
Massachusetts is actually at a very good point because it had regulations for every single modality. It's just combined them and then included a lot of the policies that were policies but weren't regulatory.
Right.
So it's really challenged. But I have a question about the workforce development. We are really challenged with regard to the pipeline for the substance abuse workforce. And so I wanted to see if there was any research out there regarding the development of more counselors and a larger workforce, especially since we're seeing Massachusetts, those that are not third-party funded, which are only non-official services, and also excluding detoxes, but for residential programs, they're usually funded by public dollars, and so that means they're not a lot of public dollars, and that's when you're usually really challenged with a highly developed workforce, a highly trained, credentialed workforce. So I wanted to see if there were any studies around increasing workforce for substance abuse treatment services across the
I've seen some stuff. I mean, part of the problem, you had the burnout, the turnover, I remember, was quite high. I think, just looking at, a few decades I've had in the field, the turnover is very high, and often counselors use this as an entry level. They enter the counseling therapy system, and then because of the difficulty of the population, the recidivism rates, they tend to move on to, easier populations to deal with. I mean, one of the challenges we have in the field really is the retention of qualified individuals. You had 45% that were recovering, and they were more committed.
Right.
So that's kind of one of the issues that how do we get professional who's not recovering to have that level of commitment the recovering counselor has. I think that remains a challenge, and maybe the bad economy where people go back and get, you know, degrees in counseling.
You know, I don't know it in addiction, but the child welfare field has been grappling this for a long time.
Yeah.
And they've just funded a huge number of kind of national entities to increase workforce. And although it's not in my area, I'm somewhat involved in my state's efforts around this, and it seems like it goes in some very interesting directions. Supervision, agency support of professional activities seem to be drivers in the child welfare workforce of retention and recruitment of professionals. So there is, what I think of is most of the professionals who are non-degreed are not former consumers in child welfare, but the same issue of professionalizing a workforce. So there may be some metaphors and knowledge there.
My question is for Dr. Polio. Did you look at drugs other than cocaine?
Not yet.
You did a urine test, mm-hmm. and you just excluded any other findings. You just looked at cocaine.
We screened for 8 substances, so we will do probably subsequent analyses of any positive test. But we thought cocaine was the most important from a clinical perspective. But we screened for opiates, marijuana, alcohol, cocaine, and I forget the last one. So.
But you didn't analyze what else you screened for?
Like not in this analysis, but we have the data.
Okay. And I have another question for Dr. Bartich.
Mm-hmm.
What are the other 4 states that you're going to target in the next phase?
We're working on getting buy-in from all 4 states now. But what we're hoping to do is Massachusetts, which is where I'm based, New York, Connecticut, and New Hampshire, which represent different systems and different sizes in terms of states.
Thank you. And how do we get copies of the slides?
I believe they're all posted to the APHA website.
Okay.
Right. Any other questions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I thought it was a very sophisticated and very informative presentation. I'm a little bit of a neophyte in this area. I'm a psychopharmacologist, MD, a psychiatrist, and my problem is actually working with counselors and trying to get them to use psychopharmacology things. I'm actually a bit of a background from Australia where I ran programs there. Available, you know, as part of the National Health Scheme. And so we used a lot of medications at Campus State, especially we were using it like 10 years ago. So this is a problem I find. And going into these drug rehab programs, they say, well, you know, what you want to do is give them drugs. We don't, they can't have drugs. So that's one thing. So, and obviously I have to do that to the university level. The second thing, though, is that in Nevada, I've just been appointed to the Commission on Mental Health and Disability Services. They're talking about they want to privatize treatment facilities. And I don't know if there's any data out to show the benefits or the disadvantages, because it's going to come up to our Commission next month. And I know the other commissioners have no clue either way. So it's going to be, someone's going to get up there and give a great presentation, then everyone will say, oh, it goes to the private. So it doesn't. So I don't know if there's anything.
I mean, part of your presentation is, you know, if the regulations for licensure are carefully written, then, you know, our data suggests that private for-profits and the private not-for-profits do very, very well in terms of comprehensiveness of services. Without the regulations being tightly written that require evidence-based practices, the ancillaries, transitional services, the data that certainly in the literature and our own data suggests that the private doesn't offer as much. They'll offer the minimum services that you require. So if you want the comprehensive offered, it needs to be in the regulations that license or certify. And she's nodding. Our Massachusetts. Oh, and you know, you're actually right. You know, that's what you found. I mean, Paul Roman's work and your all's work has really shown that there's a real resistance to buprenorphine and the medications. And I think part of it is the 45% who are recovering.
Right.
Is that there is a model in addictions that's been around my whole career that, you know, to truly recover, you've got to stop medications. And so buprenorphine, you know, methadone, whatever, you know, you shouldn't be taking. Our goal is to make you medication-free, no antidepressants, nothing. And so I think that's a real resistance, particularly in the non-medical school-based treatment programs is where that resistance starts. And I'm actually quoting every day.
Mm-hmm. And we actually have it in our licensing regulations that state you cannot deny anyone categorically because of the medication that they're on. So through licensing, we look to see their admissions and exclusionary criteria to make sure that that's not happening. And we also have denied admissions laws to follow through to see this. But we usually hear from our providers if someone's been excluded because of the medication that they're on. So, but we're, I think the innovative part of it is that we have modality management means where we have programs that actually include people on Suboxone or another medication and then talk to the other programs about how they can actually do it, because a lot of their concern is that their clients, the counselors aren't trained or they don't have the ability to respond to some of the situations that they may see. So it's all about training and workforce development and then providing the supports to either bring more resources for them or more money for case management and coordination.
Last question.
I was wondering, with increased worker retention out of recovering workers for counselors, how about increased aftercare, alumni services, association, and doing recruitment out of that? It increases sobriety.
I think you're right. I think that's what their data showed. Is that might be a manpower. If 45% of counselors are recovering, aftercare might be a good recruiting place for counselors. That's a good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's true. And that's another complex issue. One of the issues we have in drug abuse field is that, you know, we're a little concerned sometimes about the proportion of recovering people because there's a resistance to medications and
yeah.
use. So it's a complicated thing. And there are those who argue that you can't truly be a counselor unless you're recovering. So.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see with increased education, right. Master's level higher, right. They're more receptive to evidence-based practices. But then with organizational commitment being higher with counselors in recovery. So there's a lot of small details to take a look at.
Well, please join me in thanking the panel once again.
Thank you for your good questions. Thank you. Yep, I got to run over.
May I ask you a question? I'm just sort of curious from your perspective as a federal employee, and I see a lot of federal agencies not working
together. I've got to run to a poster.
A lot of federal agencies not working together. And I'm wondering if you could just sort of talk about your personal opinion about what the impact of that is at the state level.
Consider Nevada.
Oh, okay.
I'm the chairperson of the state board.
Thank you.
I'll talk to you after all of this.
Hey, Bill.
Hi.
Rita Vandenborg. Have you published those results?
No,
or?
In fact, they're very preliminary, so it's a little bit
okay.
off before I do it.
When you do, I'd love to.
Within the next, okay. Trying to get finalized in the next few months, but actually,
because I'm very interested, you know, our spending estimates.
What are you going to do now? What's your plan?
Huh? I said, what's your plan?
What question are you going to?
Yeah. But you know, and you're not dealing with dollars. But I'm saying that I need to think about that, and I have to look at the
maybe
this is a two-thirty.
Well, the slide should be online that I can forward you to something that I'm planning on. Well, we're going to put it up, and that's going to be a while.
Yeah.
too. Great presentation.
Anyway, so what I was saying is the lack of collaboration amongst federal agencies. Have you noticed like a specific impact that that has?
Well, I'm very interested when I go to the state, I'm going to be interested to see if I go up. So we're structuring our state in a very open-ended manner. Mm-hmm. The states will respond however they want to answer very
okay.
questions. And that's certainly one of the potential factors that
right.
we're waiting to see if that comes from them.
Okay.
Or, or do they just perceive things as more siloed and that's still going to safely
right.
work with their own? Because when you look at how they flow, I mean, you have federal, I mean, basically justice and education kind of have their own rules, uh-huh. and then they work with their own sense of state agencies. So at what point is there that kind of
yeah. right. And it's none of that mandated
to yeah. And you see some of the federal law, like so with the federal agencies are occasionally required to coordinate. When does that really happen?
Exactly.
And unless there's going to be that. So one of the things we're actually tracking is the amount, number of times that federal administrative agencies have to report to Congress on what they're doing. And
right.
Whether or not Congress
yeah.
has the will to do it, I mean.
Because if my impression is that when that happens and it's happening well, it's because there's one person here who's passionate about it, one person over here about coordinating and collaborating, and those people get together. And sometimes when those people lead,
well, and some, you can look at the American Ethics Office, which is related to education in the 90s, like late 90s, is that when it was going? So you get some movement around.
Yeah. Exactly. So, anyways, I think that's an interesting. There could be an interesting impact of that issue at the federal level.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So from my perspective, it's kind of where do I focus my energy?
Yeah.
And actually, it's I think it would be a lot more harder to say that at the federal level.
Oh, okay. So
yeah.
Okay.
That could be true. So. Anyways, well, thanks.
Thank
your presentation
you.
Was great.
On the APHA website?
I believe so. I think they should be.
Yeah, I think they do.
Yeah, I think they are. I think they were trying to make it very web-based in general, so.